You're listening to Monocle's House View, first broadcast on the 19th of August, 2019, on Monocle 24. This is Monocle's House View, coming up on today's program. Argentina's future. With embattled President Mauricio Macri facing an imploding economy, we'll ask how much longer he has left on the job. My guest John Everard and Victor Bulmer Thomas will discuss that and the day's other top news stories, including Japan and South Korea. Can a diplomatic head-to-head this week help bridge the divide between the two regional rivals?
This is typical Chinese flat-footed diplomacy. Setting themselves up as the mediator was a stupid thing to do. Firstly, there is no deal you can reach between South Korea and Japan that is going to leave the two parties happy. It's a question of finding a deal that both of our parties dislike equally, and everybody is going to end up hating the mediator.
Plus, as over a million protesters fill the streets in Hong Kong, we'll ask whether big numbers always spell effective action in protest movements. I'm Daniel Bache. Monocle's House View starts now. Welcome to the program. I'm joined today by John Everard, former UK ambassador to Uruguay and North Korea, among others, and Victor Bulmer Thomas, associate fellow at Chatham House. We will begin in Latin America, where Argentine President Mauricio Macri's political and economic woes have deepened. The embattled leader, having just suffered a loss in a national election primary, has also lost his economy minister over the weekend. Argentina's economy is currently in recession and posted a 22% inflation rate over the first 6 months of 2019. Victor, I'll start with you. First of all, are Macri's days numbered?
Probably, but it may be just a little bit premature, because for when we get to October and we have the elections, the opposition candidate, Alberto Fernandez, would either have to get more than 45% in the first round or more than 40% and a 10-point margin over his challenger, i.e. Macri, we assume. And you can't assume that just because of the results a week ago. So, yes, he's probably on the way out, and frankly, probably deserves to be on the way out. But people should perhaps not jump too quickly to conclusions.
I want to look at some of the reaction from around South America in a moment. But John, I wonder what the bigger concern is here for Macri in the country, his defeat in the polls or the country's worsening economic situation at this point.
Well, yes, worsening is a very polite word. I mean, we're down, I think, to 55 pesos to the dollar. Right. I remember when it was played at par with the dollar, but that's a long time ago, of course. Clearly, enormous concern. The electoral results sort of sent shockwaves, not just through the international community. People are junking Argentine bonds as fast as they can, but of course, through Argentine society. I mean, this causes huge stress for ordinary Argentines, wondering what's going to happen to their lives and how they're going to get through yet another economic storm. If you are an Argentine of, say, my age, you've been through at least four of these crises before, and everybody's come out worse at the end of them. So there'll be widespread fear.
We mentioned that Macri is in trouble in the polls, and his political days could be numbered. But I'm wondering about his opposition in this election, should he be named, Alberto Fernandez. I'm wondering about how Fernandez will fare in this, and if we expect him to win. Is that a strong prospect at this point?
Yes, it is. It's not so much that Argentines have fallen in love with Alberto Fernandez, nor indeed necessarily with his vice presidential candidate, the former president, Cristina Kirchner de Fernandez. It's more that Macri has been such a dreadful president. He made errors right from the start. And anyone who thought that he was going to be a very experienced and talented individual in the presidency was seriously at error, because he had very little political experience. He'd been mayor of Buenos Aires, but as we know from London, you can be mayor of a city, but that doesn't necessarily make you a great head of government. And of course, he did what you should never do, and that is go to the IMF too late. If you're going to go to the IMF, you should do it early on. If you go late, then, of course, the medicine that they will provide will be that much more painful, that much more severe. And that has turned out to be the case for Argentina. And now he's reaping, if you like, what he has sown.
John, I'm just curious. You mentioned, you know, Argentines have seen this story before. They are used to this, in a sense. But I wonder if this right now is playing like the past. Is this familiar to you in the cards that we're seeing from Fernandez as he goes forward towards the presidency, perhaps?
Well, yes. I mean, there are clear parallels with previous crises. The collapse in the currency. Remember the Austral and how it sort of fell apart, effectively, sort of cause of the reintroduction of the peso, the collapse of the stock markets, the flight of capital, both for international capital and domestic capital flight, of which we're seeing a great deal again this time round. So the early symptoms are indeed familiar. In previous crises, this has led to rapid shrinkage of the economy, a sudden spike in unemployment, a spike in inflation, which, sure enough, we are observing already, and general economic misery, and to political change. Now, as Victor's saying, we can't predict the results of the elections, but you know, it does. The polls do indicate that, on balance, it may well be that Fernandez wins. That, of course, doesn't solve the problems. I mean, Fernandez doesn't have a magic wand, and his talk about renegotiating the agreement with the IMF seems to me to have simply deepened the problems. He's unsettled foreign investors even more, certainly unsettled the IMF, and not actually done anything towards solving Argentina's problems, which are very deep-seated.
What is Macri saying, Victor, about how he can sort of right the ship, if anything at all, as he, you know, goes forward and let's say he is the candidate again running?
Well, he is the candidate. Yeah. There's no question about that. And I don't see him pulling out before the elections in October, as people have done in the past. I think it's fair to say that the results 8 days ago were a shock to him. It wasn't predicted by any of the opinion polls. This is therefore for him uncharted territory. So he has responded with a series of very short-term measures designed to shore up support for the lower paid and things like that. I don't think it will have a huge impact, but it might allow him to get into the second round of the presidential elections later this year. And then who knows? Because there is this factor that we need to talk about, and that is Cristina.
Right.
The vice presidential candidate for the opposition. She's the former president. She's a figure that you either love or hate. Argentines are divided around her personality. She chose not to put herself forward as the presidential candidate. But then the question is, well, will she be pulling the strings from behind the scenes? Personally, I don't think so. But a lot of people do. And that is going to be a factor if it gets into a second round.
John, what do you think about that factor? Is that a huge one? And, you know, Fernandez, if he was a good candidate, capitalizing on some, well, bad timing for the country in the economic picture, but will that help or hinder him and how voters see him?
Well, yes, Cristina is a bit of a Marmite figure, as Victor says. You either love her or you hate her. How far that is a factor depends entirely on which way that opinion divides. And the opinion polls on this are, well, frankly, after the electoral results, who trusts Argentine opinion polls in any case? And for what it's worth, they are all over the place. So, yes, it will be a factor, but nobody really knows in which way that's going to pull. The past weighs heavy. Kirchner was not a particularly popular president, certainly not by the end. And, of course, Fernandez is a Peronist, and with huge historical and psychological baggage. I mean, these are the people who way, way, way back inherited a booming, prosperous Argentina and turned into the wreck of today. Their story is not all golden.
Victor, I wonder about the Brazil factor in this and what Bolsonaro's words will mean to voters in Argentina. He's not a huge fan of Fernandez, is he?
No, and I thought it was a bit rich, though, given that Argentina, under President Macri, has had to accept an election of President Bolsonaro, which can't have been easy for them. So for him to talk about the possibilities of a President Fernandez is, frankly, a bit rich. But, I mean, like with Trump and various other demagogic figures, we have to learn how to take his words with a pinch of salt. I can't see him pulling out of Mercosur as he is threatened. I can't see him somehow, you know, breaking relations with Argentina under a new presidency. I think it's worth stressing, actually, that there were huge worries about Brazilian foreign policy under Bolsonaro. But it became clear after a few months after he was elected that foreign policy would still be very much a matter for Itamaraty, that's the Brazilian foreign ministry, as well as his extremely skillful and experienced vice president, Hamilton Mourão.
Victor Bulmer-Thomas and John Everard, thank you both. We'll be back in just a moment, but first here's Monocle's Ben Rylan with a look at some of the other headlines we're following today.
Thanks, Daniel. Sudan's former president Omar al-Bashir has arrived at court to face corruption charges. The dictator's 3 decades in power ended in April when he was ousted by the country's military. There are reports of heavy security outside the courthouse in the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. The leader of Britain's Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn, says he'll bring a vote of no confidence in Boris Johnson's government to prevent the UK leaving the European Union without a deal. Lance Price, who used to be the Labour Party's Director of Communications, told Monocle 24 about the significance of such a vote.
There is the possibility that that vote of no confidence could go against the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, in which case the question would then be what happens next. Could somebody else form a government with the current makeup of the House of Commons? Labour's view remains that it has to be Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of the opposition, the leader of the Labour Party, who forms that alternative government, although there are plenty of other people in Parliament, including some Labour MPs, who just don't think that's going to fly. So it looks as if, and I'm far from convinced that it'll play out this way, but it looks as if, were there to be a vote of no confidence, were Boris Johnson to lose, Jeremy Corbyn at least would try to form a government, and only when he failed would there then be the possibility of somebody else stepping forward.
Lance Price there. And the Danish Prime Minister, Mette Frederiksen, has told her country's media that Greenland is not for sale. The United States President Donald Trump has confirmed he would be interested in buying the world's largest island, but his comments have been met with widespread criticism. I'm Ben Rylan. That's the news. Back to you, Daniel.
Thank you, Ben. This is Monocle's House View. I'm Daniel Bache, here with John Everard, former UK diplomat, and Victor Bulmer-Thomas, associate fellow at Chatham House. Foreign ministers for South Korea, Japan, and China will meet on Wednesday this week, with China trying to mediate between the other two nations' increasingly bitter trade spat. Back in October, South Korea's Supreme Court ruled that Japanese businesses should pay reparations to South Korea's laborers who were forced to work for Japanese companies during Japan's occupation of Korea in the first half of the 20th century. John, where do we start with this?
Of course, a long, long history before this, the brutal Japanese occupation of Korea, which only ended in 1945, but also Japan's attempts to make good the damage it did. And a lot of Japanese believe quite sincerely that the deal that was reached between Japan and South Korea when the two established diplomatic relations in the 1960s, and at which point Japan handed across a very hefty check in reparations, effectively, should have closed everything down. But particularly under President Moon Jae-in, the issue simply refuses to go away. President Moon has come close to ripping up previous agreements, continually demands more money, whether it's for comfort women or this time, as you point out, for those who were forced to labour in Japanese factories, continually jibes at the Japanese over Doctor Takashima, the islands over which the two countries can't agree sovereignty, and appears to be playing this domestically for all it's worth. A lot of Japanese have a kind of sinking feeling that what is really at issue here is not the rights and the wrongs of what the Japanese Imperial Army did in Korea, which I think everybody agrees was reprehensible, but President Moon Jae-in's political future. His opinion, his poll ratings are plummeting. He has mishandled the economy. His one success story, quote unquote, the handling of North Korea, has over the last 10 days, fortnight, turned sour on him, and he is desperately looking for a good news story to boost his ratings. And it looks like beating up on Japan has taken his fancy.
Well, even to the point of South Korea, you know, calling for the boycott of Japanese trade or goods, I wonder about that. But also in a time when with, you know, China being so powerful, it seems strange that Moon Jae-in, trying to win back some popularity, would be attacking Japan. What do you think of that, Victor?
Well, There are many strange things about this. One is that in South Korea and Japan, you have two steadfast allies of the United States with whom the U.S. has strong security agreements. Indeed, it's a security guarantor for both countries. And therefore, in the past, you would have had the United States administration stepping in to make peace between two allies. And that isn't happening here. Mm. As a result, China is filling that gap. But of course, China has its own issues with Japan, and they also go back to the Second World War. And so probably China is not the best sort of honest broker to handle a dispute between Japan and South Korea. We shall see. It's a real test, if you like, of Chinese diplomatic skills to see if it can broker a deal, which under normal circumstances you would have expected the United States to do.
Indeed. I mean, not the best honest broker is masterly understatement. This is typical Chinese flat-footed diplomacy. Setting themselves up as the mediator was a stupid thing to do. Firstly, there is no deal you can reach between South Korea and Japan that is going to leave the two parties happy. It's a question of finding a deal that both parties dislike equally, and everybody is going to end up hating the mediator. Secondly, nobody trusts the Chinese. I mean, nobody trusts the Chinese full stop, but nobody trusts the Chinese particularly when it comes to dealings with regional powers. Anti-Japanese feeling in China is just as strong as it is in South Korea. And the Japanese have said almost so many words, we're not having this, and have fixed up a bilateral meeting between the Japanese and the South Korean foreign minister in Beijing, but without the Chinese present. Thirdly, of course, by putting yourself forward as the mediator, you are bizarrely aligning your interests with those of the United States. And you know, what happens if you find yourself inching towards a deal, but of course you need to address security issues? At some point, China has to go cap in hand to the United States to ask it to co-mediate, and that really would stick in throats in Beijing.
I'm curious about why they did step forward. I mean, China, we can assume, will want something out of this, Victor, but is it to further drive the wedge between those traditional allies, or what is their main goal in this?
No, I wouldn't have thought so. Mm. No, I mean, I can't see that would be in China's interest, but everything has to be seen, I think, in the context of the dispute, which is often defined as a trade dispute between China and the United States, but clearly is much more than about trade. And it may be that this has to be seen as part of the leverage, because as John says, if in the end China's role can only work if somehow the US is involved, well, you could see China claiming a certain amount of credit, if you like, in the bank when it comes to resolving its own long-term issues with the United States. Mm.
John, just lastly on this, perhaps with South Korea and Japan not having the best economic picture in either country, what are they really hoping to get out of this moving forward?
I think the Japanese, at least when they meet Foreign Minister Kang in Beijing on Wednesday, will be hoping at least for an agreement that both sides don't do anything to make the situation worse. Just cool it. Don't take any further measures and form working parties to try to work through some of the issues here. I mean, there are viable solutions technically if they can be made to fly politically in Tokyo and particularly in Seoul. Let's hope they get somewhere.
Indeed. And we'll be keeping an eye on that ahead of talks on Wednesday. Let us go now to Hong Kong, where we have been talking a lot about the protests going on there over the weekend. Over reportedly took part in Hong Kong's ongoing pro-democracy protests, hampered by the rain yesterday, but still lots of people were out. Now entering these demonstrations, their 11th continuous week, expecting more violent clashes, at least more demonstrations. And let's have a little listen to what the streets sounded like yesterday. Now, if we do the math, organizers said 1.7 million protesters were out. That would be about a quarter of Hong Kong's entire population. And as our bureau chief did point out this morning, there were a lot of pro-government demonstrators out as well yesterday. So we're just wondering, how much clearer a signal does a government need to be given that change is going to happen? John, what is your sense on Hong Kong at this moment?
No, I think asking how much signal a government needs that change is going to happen, that's not the way way things are. Mm. Beijing doesn't look at what people are thinking. It is driven by quite different considerations: stability, the prestige of leadership, and the overwhelming need not to appear weak. Mm. They will regard the protests as a nuisance. I suspect that in the corridors of power, they believe quite genuinely that they are all being stirred up by foreigners. You know, if it's bad, it must be foreign, and they will write it off in that sense. Their question isn't, you know, are we doing this wrong? Because, of course, the Communist Party of China doesn't do anything wrong, does it, comrade? Mm. The question is, what do we do about this? How do we stop it spreading? And they have been threatening, not quite in so many words, but in terms of troop demonstrations, a massive and forceful intervention, though, of course, they'd be reluctant to do that. Right. Reluctant not just because they know that world opinion would turn against them, but hanging in the background is Taiwan. Mm. And they know that if they break all their agreements, go marching into Hong Kong, crush these demonstrations with force, then Xi Jinping ends up being the Chinese president who lost Taiwan permanently. Mm. And that he's clearly deeply, deeply reluctant to contemplate.
Victor, if we look at the scale of these demonstrations and how much they have grown, also the list of demands has grown as well. It's beyond now asking Carrie Lam to step down, but does that give you the sense that there is more of a change on the way with the scale in the size of what we're seeing now?
No, but let me just quickly make a point about numbers. I'm always mystified why it's so difficult to get reasonably accurate numbers about people protesting on the streets. We had the same problem in London in 2003 when the organizers gave a figure of 2 million. The government implied it was 500,000, and now people seem to have settled on a figure of about 1 million. Here we have the organizers saying 1.7 million, the police saying 128,000. I mean, who knows? Clearly, it was a very large number. You can see that from the pictures. But I just think it's very strange in these days when everything is monitored, everything is captured on camera. Why on earth we can't have a more precise figure that we can all agree on? Having said that, I think the problem for the demonstrators is that they have no clear demands. If it was simply Carrie Lam stepped down and they just focused on that and nothing else, well, that's something which obviously Beijing would not contemplate in the short run, but might be willing to consider in a few months' time. But because the demands seem to become more diffuse with the passage of time, I think it actually undermines the position of the protesters. So from China's point of view, it's clearly in their interest to play a long game as long as they don't lose face because of damage to property or whatever it is, you know. We shall see. But as John very astutely said, Taiwan is very much in the background of everyone's thinking, and that is surely far more important to China at this moment than any sort of quick fix of the Hong Kong issue.
Very interesting. And perhaps yesterday the count was a little bit off because of all the umbrellas that were out there. And maybe the symbology is interesting if you look back to the umbrella protests of past in Hong Kong. But I wonder, John, are leaders removed from reality when they start to ignore numbers and size and play around with those figures, or how much they really matter and how much they actually think about them?
How much they really matter depends entirely on the level of political power that is devolved in a society to the people. Tony Blair ignoring, was it 1 million or 2 million? We don't know. People on the streets protesting against the Iraq war, we now know with the benefit of hindsight, was toxic and one of the and something from which he never really recovered. Of course, China, including Hong Kong, doesn't work that way. The Chinese authorities routinely ignore mass demonstrations, which are very rarely reported on, shoot people from time to time, and life goes on. Mm. And remember that President Trump, yesterday, day before, said he really hoped that this didn't turn into a second Tiananmen. Remember that from the point of view of the Chinese leadership, the Tiananmen massacre was a tremendous success. People protest against you, you take them out, you shoot them. And when you shoot them, they stop demonstrating. Simple as that. Mm. Then after Tiananmen, the world protested and China was in the doghouse for how many weeks was it? At which point the world decided it had to keep trading with China on China's terms, leading to 30 years of breakneck growth. What's not to like? Mm. I mean, we would deplore Chinese marching into Hong Kong on humanitarian grounds. Those kind of grounds simply do not wash in Beijing.
Victor, just lastly, I wonder about your thoughts on Donald Trump in this and how he's waded him into the middle and sort of mercurial. We're not sure exactly which side he's on. He's been on the side of the Chinese, but also trying to stay, you know, on the side of free speech.
Well, he's not noted for his defense of human rights around the world, and I don't think he's going to break the habit of a lifetime over Hong Kong. Again, as I said earlier on, I think he will be probably seeing this much more in terms of the broader relationship between China and the United States. Just on the point earlier you made about, you know, what numbers does it take to have an impact on leaderships, it seems that in the short run, almost zero impact, although there are a few counterexamples. Earlier this year, we had 6 million people sign a petition to revoke Article 50, had zero impact on the government. Whether they will come to regret that in years or months to come, who knows? Time will tell. As John said, you can't really be sure for many years until have passed before you will exactly know what the impact of a particular protest is. So, in other words, it's always worth protesting if you feel strongly about something, because at the end of the day, it may turn out to be worthwhile. But you will never know on the day itself.
Victor Bulmer-Thomas and John Everard, thank you both. In a moment, we'll have the latest view from Monocle's editorial floor. You are listening to Monocle's House View. Stay tuned. This is Monocle's House View. I'm Daniel Bache. Lastly, on today's program, a view from our editorial floor. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is facing a backlash after a report found he'd acted unethically in a row with his now former Attorney General. But will it change voters' minds heading into Election Day?
So many of you here, I've been coming to Parliament Hill since I was a little kid for Canada Day.
What a difference 4 years can make. In 2015, Justin Trudeau's political future looked bright as the young, fresh-faced, progressive Liberal leader became Canada's new Prime Minister, prompting the rest of the world to sit up and take note of the country in a way they hadn't in decades. Now, as another general election looms, Trudeau's sparkling persona has lost some of that sheen. The SNC-Lavalin controversy, where Trudeau was accused by his Attorney General of trying to interfere in the criminal case against SNC-Lavalin, a Quebec-based company accused of bribing foreign officials, seemed to have died down earlier this year. But the scandal once again erupted last week when an ethics watchdog released a report confirming that the Prime Minister had acted unethically. The report is definitely a bad look for the PM. But we here at Monocle aren't convinced that the scandal will actually lead to devastation for Trudeau at the ballot box come October. Though his political opponents and conservative columnists have worked overtime to capitalise on his tarnished image, many Canadians have met the scandal with a collective shrug. Trudeau may no longer be squeaky clean, but opinion polls still predict the Liberals are likely to win the most seats in October.
Happy Canada Day!
And that is all for today's program. Monocle's House View was produced by Tom Hall. Our studio managers were Steph Chungu and David Stevens. Coming up at 1900 London time, a brand new edition of Monocle on Culture. Monocle's House View is back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. I'm Daniel Bache. Thank you so much for listening and goodbye.